It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Co-host Veronica Rickert will be back with me on Monday. Coming up next, the police shooting of an unarmed black teenager in Ferguson, Missouri, is causing people to ask where the outrage is closer to home, in Milwaukee, over violence in the African-American community. We'll talk to a guest who says we need to stop talking and start acting when it comes to changing our cities, and we'll hear from someone who works with at-risk youth. First, the Wisconsin Sustainable Business Council is with us to release their latest Wisconsin Sustainability Report. For the last 5 years, the council has released annual reports looking at sustainability in three areas in Wisconsin: the environment, economy, and society. Thomas Eggert joins us now. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Sustainable Business Council. Tom, welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So I'll ask you a huge question because it's kind of a big report across these three categories: economy, environment, society. How sustainable is Wisconsin?
Well, it'd be great if we had something to compare ourselves to. Mm-hmm. At this point, I think we're still the only state that is putting out what we call a triple bottom line report, triple bottom line being the economic, social, and environmental picture for the state. As we saw in the report, there are good things, things that we should really be proud of, and areas that I think that there are really opportunities for improvement.
We'll dig into some of both categories, but what's the reasoning? What's the concept between this State of Sustainable Wisconsin report that you're doing?
Business has been doing these reports for 5 years, 7 years, 10 years in some cases, and they use these reports as a mechanism both to communicate successes and challenges. And I posed the question to my students 5 years ago now, could we do something comparable for the state? What would be the key economic, environmental, and social indicators that were chosen? And so every year there's a team of students or a group of students that works in this. They pick out the indicators that are most top of mind to them and assemble the information. There's nothing new in this report. This is all existing information from other organizations that we've woven together to tell a story about Wisconsin.
It's sort of an atlas of what's going on here in the state. But it's
correct.
Around this core concept of sustainability. What do we mean by that in this context?
So sustainability, the classic definition, the Brundtland Commission definition says, all right, sustainability is what do we do now, development that meets the current needs of our population, so current in Wisconsin, and doesn't sacrifice the ability of future generations to meet their needs. So how do we look to the future and maximize our chances of having a life that we would want for our kids in the future?
So what are some of the high points? What have we got going for us in Wisconsin that really stood out this year?
So let's talk. I mean, everybody's talking about jobs. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about jobs. We have 77,000 green jobs in the state, green being associated with alternative energy, energy efficiency, alternative transportation, green building. I mean, things that we should really be proud of and that are growth areas. Many of those jobs are actually in the manufacturing sector. We have more manufacturing jobs per capita than any other state in the country. Our history, we're grounded as a manufacturing state. So what should we be manufacturing? One of the things that the report suggests is, well, let's look at things like wind towers or solar panels or component parts to those kinds of things. And in fact, we have many companies that are doing that.
Staying on that theme, as a flip side of that, an area of concern you point out is that we still rely pretty heavily on coal for our energy, our electricity in particular in Wisconsin.
Right. So we're 40th in the nation as far as weaning ourselves off coal, or the other way of looking at that is we're the 10th most dependent state on coal, which becomes a big deal as we talk about climate change and what's going to happen. How does the price of energy reflect the potential risk that we run? If there would be something like a carbon tax, given that we are so coal dependent, we're going to be disproportionately impacted. On the other hand, we have a lot of opportunity for changing the percentage of our energy that we generate from coal. One of the downsides of generating so much energy from coal is that we send $16 billion a year out of state for paying for fuel. That if we would have more solar, more wind, more biomass, that money would all be staying here in state.
Turning to another indicator, and there are a lot of negatives here. We hear a lot about this, including on this show, racial divisions, gaps between African-Americans and whites, among other gaps. What kind of indicators did you look at? What did you find?
So one of the great things, one of the things we should be proud of, is that we are second in the nation in high school graduation rates. We're second in the nation in ACT scores. And when you start breaking that down, you look at graduation rates, we actually lead the nation with 96% of our white high school students graduating, but only 66% of our African-American students are graduating. So, again, there's lots of opportunity, I think, for the state in addressing and making some pretty significant progress in addressing those kinds of numbers.
And in the economic and environmental side, I think different people might look at the report and see some things that are as pros, and some people might look and say the same thing are cons.
Sure.
Opportunities for mining in Wisconsin. Some people excited about the job and economic opportunities there. Other people are saying, wait, environmental sustainability, doesn't that come at a cost? How do you, in the report, how do you weigh those two factors?
Well, so mining growth in the state right now, let me say it this way. Mining as a component of the U.S. economy is the fastest growing sector. In the state, we went from having 10 sand mines to having 110 sand mines in 3 years. So there are going to be challenges as we reconcile what role should mining play in the state. Obviously, there's the iron mine that is very controversial up in the northern part of the state also. So what we're trying to do in the report is point out really just what's happening. Others can have the discussion about what are the consequences of that. Let me switch over and talk about, we lead the nation in manure digesters, in energy generated from farm animals to electricity. On the other hand, we had more manure spills in the state last year than we had had in the last 7 years. We lead the nation in the number of organic dairy farms and meat farms. We're number one in the nation in the number of paper makers. So there's a lot of things that we can really be proud of that we highlighted in the report.
Now, a lot of times when somebody lays out a problem, people look to government as a solution to improve the problem. This is pitched toward the business community in the state, as I understand it. So when you're pointing out the room for improvement, whether we're talking about racial disparities, environmental problems, unemployment, whatever, what can the business community take from this and run with?
So it really, one of our core audiences is economic development professionals. And as they're seeking to bring business to the state, business is looking, in spite of what we may think and in spite of some of the evidence, business is looking at more than who's going to give them the best tax package or the best, sort of financial package. They're looking for quality of life indicators. They're looking for education and educational opportunities. They're going to be trying to attract to the state highly educated people from other states. So it's the whole package. It's the sustainability package. And so we try and highlight areas that we should be really proud of, as I said, and areas that there's some room for improvement.
Now, whether we're talking about, say, a local environment or economic development person or a local business person, are most people thinking long-term sustainability in these areas, or is it we're kind of paying attention to the day-to-day thing and not having that longer-term vision?
Yeah, it's one of the hardest things, especially for business to do, because our businesses respond to very short-term signals.
We got to stay open today.
We have to meet the numbers this quarter. And those pressures discourage sustainability thinking. Sustainability is more thinking long-term, thinking, how are we likely to be in business in 5 years, in 10 years, in 20 years? What do we need to do to position ourselves? If we start thinking about, well, where are energy prices likely to go over the next 10 years? Everybody's going to say, well, they're likely to go up. If we put in solar panels, we're locking in our energy rates for those 10 years. We know exactly what we're going to be paying 10 years from now because we're not paying for any fuel. I mean, we're making payments on whatever investment that there was. That's an example of long-term thinking.
Tom, it's a great snapshot of what's going on in the state. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Let me just put in a plug. We actually have a conference coming up in early December. Mm-hmm. where we bring business people together to learn from each other. And that'll be December 3rd at the Harley-Davidson Museum in Milwaukee.
All right, and website for info about that?
WisconsinSustainability.com.
All right. We've been speaking with Thomas Eggert. He's Executive Director of the Wisconsin Sustainable Business Council. He's just released the results of the council's annual Wisconsin Sustainability Report. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about violence in Milwaukee. Since an unarmed black teenager was shot by a police officer in Ferguson, Missouri last month, people have been bringing attention to violence closer to home in Wisconsin's biggest city, some asking where the outrage is over violence in the African-American community. This sparked a column by James Causey urging people to stop talking about the violence and to start acting. He joins us now. He's an editorial writer and columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he joins us in our Milwaukee studio. James, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
And we also have in our studio there in Milwaukee, Lakita Caldwell. She's a senior program manager at the Boys and Girls Club of Greater Milwaukee. Lakita, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, James, let's start with you. Why did you feel the need to write that column?
Well, that's kind of interesting. Every single time there's a shooting in the central city, I get email after email from people saying, you know, James, where's the outrage? How come people are not upset over this? And what they tried to do recently is tie in the number of shootings in Milwaukee to the outrage that was sparked in Ferguson. And I was responding to people individually saying there is outrage, but it's being shown in different ways. And there are a lot of people doing things to address it. And so I wanted to point out a lot of the organizations that are working day and night to help kids and help families. And you can see the outrage if you open your eyes. You see it in what people are doing with the memorials that they put up when people die. You see it when you go to the funerals, and I've been to a number of funerals this year and last year. You see it in people crying out, saying that they're tired of the violence. You see it in kids' faces when they go to school every day. And you see it in the pain and anguish of the parents who lose a kid or have a kid injured to violence. So the outrage is there. It's just that I was telling people, don't expect every single time someone is shot to have people marching up and down the street, because that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, because you don't see that, you don't see the anger. The anger and outrage is there.
In your column, you quote an alderman who says Milwaukee is just one or two deaths away from becoming like Ferguson. Do you think things are that tense, that tenuous there?
I was quoting Malele Coggs when she made that statement. And, you know, honestly, you know, you never know. It depends on the shooting. I mean, I think there was a lot of outrage when a child was killed on her playground while she was playing, doing what kids do, and there was a lot of outrage over that. So it depends on the shooting. It depends on the circumstances. It depends on a lot of things. But I think that all the elements are there for us to turn into a Ferguson. Yes, indeed, I do believe that. But I think it's the efforts made by people like Lakita Caldwell, and what she's doing at the Boys and Girls Club in Milwaukee and others that are helping to try to maintain the calm and try to give kids positive things to do.
And Lakita, let's get into that. What kind of work are you doing there in the community to try to tackle some of these problems?
Well, one of the programs that I had the opportunity to create at the Boys and Girls Club is called Can You Hear Us Now? And it takes a look at the impact of trauma in the Lindsay Heights area. Young people are able to use different genres of art to express some of the traumas that they have faced in their community. The great thing about this program is that we can't do it by ourselves. We partner with the Milwaukee Police Department and the Fire Department. The aldermen worked with us that the kids actually interviewed all of the individuals from those organizations. And they also work with faith-based communities to find out how they grew up in the Milwaukee and what are some things that they can do to help support the young people and some of the issues that they're facing.
Lakita, you talked about the trauma that young people face. How do you see that? How, until they have the outlet that you're talking about, how does that trauma show itself?
we see the trauma. A lot of times we don't focus on it, but we see it when a young person is angry. There's a book that I read called She's Not Angry for Nothing, but the young people are not just, they don't just wake up and I'm angry. A lot of times they're angry because of an issue. For instance, some of the young people talked about seeing someone getting shot and not having counseling for that. This program came from a situation that I witnessed. I went to a young person's funeral and a fight broke out. I was traumatized from it. I ended up getting strep throat. So then I started to ask the question, what are the things that our young people are seeing? We see the behavior, and a lot of people say that our kids are bad. They're not bad. They're dealing with a lot of heavy issues that they shouldn't have to deal with. And the great thing about the Boys and Girls Club is we have a lot of programs that prevent, you know, our doors are open every day from 2:30 to 8 o'clock. And we get them off the streets and we give them opportunity. We get jobs for our teens. We have academic support. So with support in programs like Can You Hear Us Now, they have opportunities to not focus on the trauma or have a safe space where they have adults who they can talk to and get for us to get the help that they need to deal with the traumas that they have experienced.
Let's talk about Can You Hear Us Now, and it gives them a voice, an artistic voice in a way. What kind of things have come out of that?
From Can You Hear Us Now, we had a documentary that we premiered at the Oriental Theater. 1,100 people from the community. We have officers come. We had philanthropists come. And they heard, they were able to see, we had over 300 hours worth of footage. And they were able to see what took place in class. What were some of the stories that came out of doing the workshops? Another great thing about Can You Hear Us Now, it's not just the classwork, it's the field work. We took them to a college. We went to UW-Madison. We went to the Milwaukee Film Festival. They were one of our partners. The partners that were a part of this program really helped out. The media helped out. Fox 6 did a story where they came out and interviewed the young people, and they were actually able to hear from the voice of the young people's struggles that they have. And the dream Milwaukee they wished that they had. So it was a great community partnership. This year, we're doing a play. The kids are going to write a play, and in just a few weeks, we're going to pick the issue that we're going to focus on for the 2014-2015 season.
So James, talking about the concept of outrage related to what Lakita was just talking about, do you see more and more people taking their anger, maybe their frustration with the situation, and saying, okay, I can't just be mad. I need to find a way to work on this and find groups that I can be a part of?
Well, of course, you're going to have people who take a positive aspect and try to be a part of programs like Lakita's and be a part of some of the other programs I mentioned in the column. But then again, you're going to have some people who act out and because they don't have or they don't see another way to act. Like, for instance, I visit a lot of schools and I talk to a lot of young people. And I think the anger goes beyond just the violence that especially our young black boys endure. It's the always feeling like you're a suspect kind of thing that our boys endure. Like, I remember over the summer, I went to this program where these boys had got together and these men were talking to them about, you know, how do they feel when they go to the store and things like that. And I remember this young man said when he would go into like this gas station to buy snacks or something like that, he talked about this look. And it's the look that he gets from adults who always suspect that he's up to no good. And he said, even though he doesn't steal or do anything like that, when you're constantly being portrayed as a threat or as someone who will steal something, take something, hit you or do something bad to you, it makes you want to act out. And people like this young man who I see is on the fence, they need programs to keep them on the straight and narrow, because we all know that it only takes one instance to get you in trouble. And once you get, you know, involved in the incarceration web, it's almost impossible to get out.
Briefly, while you're working from that end to keep those kids in the straight and narrow, are there ways to reach out and maybe have the storekeeper not give that look?
You know what? That's a conversation that I think this community needs to have. It's a conversation our nation needs to have. It's a deep conversation about race, and it's something that no one wants to be looked at as a racist. So, You know, I don't know how you even start that conversation. I've written columns saying how it could start, though. I said, you know, start having lunch with someone who doesn't look like you. Just don't work with the person. Get to know who that person is, who you probably don't even talk to any other time. Get to know people who just don't look like you. Include people in your circle who are of different races and things like that, and start that conversation.
We're talking to James Causey and Lakita Caldwell about community programs in Milwaukee, trying to build community and reduce violence. And we want to hear from you. What programs do you think could help young people, or maybe anybody for that matter, feel like a part of the community? Have you done what James just said, gone out and had lunch or dinner with someone who's part of a different community in one way or another, somebody you usually wouldn't cross paths with in daily life? Have you gotten involved in an effort, a community effort like the ones we're talking about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation after the news and get your calls as well. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our discussion now about how some community leaders and community organizations are working to curb violence and build community in Milwaukee. You can join the conversation. Do you have something like this in your town, whether it's Milwaukee or elsewhere? What kinds of programs you'd like to see to make people feel more involved and connected? Do you have suggestions that might help curb violence, foster responsibility, accountability? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email at talk@wpr.org. Staying with us are James Causey, editorial writer and columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Lakita Caldwell, senior program manager at the Boys and Girls Club of Greater Milwaukee. Lakita, you were telling us about the programs you have there and the community organizations that get involved. Do you have a pretty good volunteer base? Do a lot of local people come in and say, hey, how can I help?
Yes, we have a huge volunteer base. A lot of the businesses volunteer for us, like Northwestern Mutual, State Farm. We have a lot, and that's just the few of the companies that volunteer with us. We have colleges, Marquette, UWM, Mount Mary, Alverno. We have a lot of students who volunteer with us as well. So we have a lot. Our kids are exposed to some of the greatest leaders in the city of Milwaukee.
And who are the kids? Can anybody show up and join in, or do you go out to schools and bring people in to participate in things like the Can You Hear Us Now program?
Yes. Right now, we are actually recruiting for the 2014-2015 cohort for Can You Hear Us Now? And it takes place at Laverne Way Boys and Girls Club, so any young person between the ages of 13 to 18 can be a part of the program.
And James, in your column that kind of touched off this conversation, Lakita's group is one of the ones you mentioned. What are some of the other bright spots you see in the Milwaukee area?
Well, there are a lot of bright spots, and I just touched on maybe a fraction of them. I mean, there's the garden where they teach young boys how to not only plant seeds for vegetables and things like that. They also, the men act as mentors, and they plant seeds in these young men to teach them how to be men. There's efforts made in MPS led by Kwabanan Nixon and Muhib Dyer, that program where it's like where they get young boys to talk about some of the trauma that they experience. And that's something that you almost have to see for yourself. It's called I Will Not Die Young campaign. And basically, I take the boys out of class and they put them in a separate room, and they have a conversation with them about some of the things that they experience in life, some of the traumas that they experience. And one thing that hit me is when they had roughly 30 or 40 boys in the class, and they said, how many boys here have seen their mother hit or struck by another man? And like 80% of the hands went up. Mm-hmm. How many boys in here who have a relationship with their father? And only like, you know, a handful of boys raised their hand. How many boys have seen someone die or had someone close to you die a violent death, all the hands went up. So when you have things like that, and these traumas are not being addressed in a professional manner, how can you expect kids to come to school prepared and ready to learn when they dealt with so much stuff before they got to school at 7:45 or 8 o'clock that we can't even imagine? And so those are the traumas that we need to start addressing. And so when we talk about the things that like a public education needs to do, public education has changed since we were kids. I mean, it's not just a place where you learn. These places are social centers where they deal with all kinds of things now that you can't even imagine, and they have to educate all kids. And it's tough, and cutting funding to public education is not the answer, and it's not going to help solve this problem.
I want to bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Rick on the line in Grafton. Rick, hi.
Hi. I want to tell all the listeners out there and the kids that there's hope, because I was homeless for 4 years, very much abused. I'm not going to get all the detail, and I'm white, but it doesn't matter what color you are. But my neighborhood, people stabbed each other. They were going to prison. Again, very dark. Right, and this is in the 60s and 70s. Now, 30, 40 years later, because of the Boys Club, it wasn't a combined club back then, because of the volunteers, the money given, I'm proud to say that I give back to my community. I'm in a higher income situation, respected my community, and it can be traced back to two organizations, United Way and the Boys Club. If it wasn't for being able to talk to people, hang out there and have hope, who knows where I'd have been. So I want whatever higher powers to bless these people, and I want the listeners, support the Boys and Girls Club, please.
Thank you so much. We appreciate that.
Rick, thanks for the call. Lakita, Rick, definitely a success story, sounds like, for the then Boys Club. I mean, do you see a lot of those success stories coming out of programs like the ones you do?
Yes, we see it all of the time. People like Denzel Washington are alumni, Boys and Girls Club alumni. You have Jennifer Lopez. You have Mark Wahlberg. You have a lot of individuals who said that if it wasn't for the Boys and Girls Club, they don't know where they would be, because we're a family. We have a safe space for young people. We've been around for 127 years, and we offer a safe space. We go to outside of the Boys and Girls Club. We go to the kids' football games. We go to the basketball games. We're at their schools when they graduate. So it's a holistic social emotional. In our programs, we focus on social emotional learning. It's the whole child. It's the education. It's their emotional ability and the family, because we can't do it by ourselves. We have to know their parents and make sure that their home is okay, because if their lights are out for half of the summer, the kid is not going to be okay when they come into the Boys and Girls Club. Every day we greet them at the door and we say, "How was your day?" And normally when we say, "How was your day?" the young people respond and tell us how it was, and then we're able to help them.
You mentioned, thanks again for the call, Rick. We've touched on one view from the outside. Lakita mentioned these are not inherently bad kids. They're in a bad situation. Another view from the outside, looking in at an urban environment with poverty, is maybe a feeling of hopelessness. James, is it important to overcome that view?
Of course. I mean, you know, it's easy to lose hope, especially in a city that has a lot of problems like ours. You know, we know that we tend to lead all the negative statistics when it comes to, you know, educational gap between blacks and whites, poverty levels, infant mortality, things like that. Sometimes it could seem like, you know, if you're African-American here, you don't really have much of a chance. But you know what we need to do? We need to get back to the old way of doing things. We have to stay involved. We have to become mentors when we can. And it shouldn't be up to people like Lakita Caldwell and the Muhib Dyers of the world to try to fix all these problems. I mean, each and every one of us could do a little bit. We could do our part. We could get involved. And, you know, mentoring doesn't cost a thing. You know, and a lot of people think it comes down to cost. Giving your time doesn't cost anything, but it could really save a person's life.
You know, it's no secret Milwaukee, very segregated racially and by income level. Similar stories true in Madison, elsewhere in the state. Lakita, is it important for you that you get community support, not just from the community that you're based in, but from the the white community, the higher income communities of the Milwaukee area?
It takes a village to raise a child. So everyone's support, like what James was saying, mentorship is very important. And the Boys and Girls Club, it's affordable. It's $5 for the whole year. So when we go on field trips, if a kid can't afford the $5 for the year, they can still come to the Boys and Girls Club because we have individuals who give. And that's how we're able to open our doors every day. We have 44 sites in the city of Milwaukee, and we're able to open our doors for $5 for every – we have 41,000 youth that we serve, and we're able to serve all of them because of the support of the community. The community in Milwaukee is great to our local Boys and Girls Club, and we're very grateful for each and every one, even the dollar. If someone gives a dollar to our organization, a kid is allowed to be off the street and safe and have hope, and they're loved every time they come into our doors.
James, we get a lot of attention to gun violence, in particular in Milwaukee. The mayor's been on our show talking about what he wants to do to turn that around. A lot of the things we're talking about today sound great, but they're not going to pay off, you know, next week. It's going to be a slow burn before these kind of things take an effect. Are there things that you think could make a difference in the shorter run?
Well, you know, shorter run, I think what we got to really focus on is jobs, you know. And this sounds like a broken record, and we all know the answers to these questions. Like, for instance, you know, 80% of black youth don't know what it's like to have a summer job in this city. That's a shame on all of us. I think, you know, if we really want to make immediate change, every company here can say, okay, if we're taking on an intern over the summer, if we're taking on 5 interns, we're going to stretch our budget and take on a 6th one. If we never had anyone who interned for us, we're going to take 1 person. I mean, I think when I think about it, I started my first internship in high school when I was like 14 years old working for the Community Journal, and I had internships all the way through. I was lucky enough. So I was able to see so much. I was able to see professionals and what to wear to work, how to act, how to conduct myself, and things like that that you really don't kind of learn in school. And my parents taught me these things, so I would have learned them anyway, but I actually saw it firsthand from outside of my family structure. So, I mean, a job means so much more than just a paycheck. It teaches you responsibility. It teaches you how to conduct yourself. It teaches you a lot. So we could start with jobs. Mm-hmm. But I want to piggyback off of what Lakita said about the village aspect. None of these problems will be solved by the black community alone, and it can't be looked at as just a black community problem. That's not our problem. If we start doing that, nothing will get solved, because this will take everyone to have a vested interest in the welfare of our kids. I mean, you're looked at as a city. The health of a city is basically based on the outcomes of their children.
Right.
If you have your children struggling and dying on the streets, then who could be satisfied with that? I don't know. I get pretty upset when I hear that, when it's, you know, what should we do? Everyone should be involved.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to James Causey and Lakita Caldwell. They're with us to discuss some of the work being done in Milwaukee to address the violence there. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Time for our state news roundup. Lots of headlines in the race for governor. New news guy Noah Ovshinsky is back with us. Noah, welcome back.
It's good to be here. Thanks, Rob.
Well, a lot of political news heating up, a little bit here, a little bit there, and some news out today about the Mary Burke campaign. What's going on?
Yeah, so some big news. In fact, this just broke, in the last 24 hours. Apparently, portions of Mary Burke's jobs plan, which she released several months ago, were taken word for word, essentially, from the campaigns of 3 other out-of-state Democrats who have run in the past few years.
So since this broke, I imagine the other side, the Walker campaign, is all over that?
Yeah, the Walker campaign really jumped on the news, which was first reported by BuzzFeed last night. Campaign officials told the Journal Sentinel it was a sad day for Wisconsin because the Democratic nominee misled voters. They went on to say today that it proves Burke can't be trusted to lead the state.
And have we heard from the Burke campaign itself at this point?
Yeah, so the Burke campaign, unsurprisingly, is downplaying the whole episode. She told the Journal Sentinel that it was a, quote, relatively minor mistake, and that the Walker campaign's reaction was really meant to distract voters from the latest job numbers. We'll talk about those actually in a few minutes. But long story short, they put Wisconsin 33rd in the nation for private sector job growth.
So I guess a question here, are we talking about plagiarism? How has the Burke campaign answered that question?
Right. So her spokesperson also reiterated today to the Journal Sentinel, that this is not a case of plagiarism, although parts of the job plan did appear in previous job plans around the country. This was not a case of plagiarism, as some have suggested, namely the Walker campaign, because the spokesperson argues that while sections had appeared in previous campaigns, it all came from the same person. It was all written by the same person.
The same person.
Right. So the Burke campaign is blaming really a consultant that they hired, blaming this whole episode on this person, because this same consultant, while working for the Burke campaign, had previously worked on campaigns where portions of those jobs plans were taken from, essentially.
So this person, in effect, we're speculating here, but cribbed his or her own work that they had done elsewhere instead of lifting somebody else's work, I guess.
Exactly.
Would be the argument.
Yeah, exactly. And included it in this latest jobs plan, or parts of the jobs plan put forward by the Burke campaign.
Hopefully they crossed off other states' names and put Wisconsin.
One would hope.
Okay. And is this consultant still with this campaign?
No, the Burke campaign says they have terminated their relationship with the consultant.
All right, well, we'll watch and see if this is a momentary flare-up or something with legs.
Yeah, we'll see. It's a tight race.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Well, and another thing that people have been anticipating in this tight race, the latest batch of job numbers. And these are the biggies, right?
Right. This is what we've come to call the gold standard jobs numbers. And this will be the last batch that will be released before the election in November. And really what they show is job growth from March of last year to the March of this year.
Okay. So both sides arguing over how the governor's job performance has been. What do we see in these numbers?
Right. I mean, job performance is a big part of these campaigns. Mm-hmm. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, private sector jobs grew by about 1.3%. And that's less than the nation as a whole, which had job growth of 2.1%.
So how do we compare state to state?
Yeah. So as I mentioned a few minutes ago, this puts us 33rd in the nation for private sector job growth.
And then we've seen dueling ads from the campaigns. We rank, depending on how you look at it, third among Midwestern states, last among Midwestern states. With these numbers, where do we fall?
Right. Well, according to these latest numbers, when you compare us to our other Midwestern neighbors, Wisconsin finished behind all but Illinois and Minnesota.
All right. So not to throw out too many numbers, but new poll numbers out this week showing the race is neck and neck. Campaigns are watching these numbers like a lot of people watch their fantasy football results. What are we hearing from the campaigns about these new job numbers?
Right. So the timing is key here, given that we're just, a matter of weeks away from this election. The Burke campaign has used, these jobs numbers to attack Governor Walker, as she had previous jobs reports. As we've talked about a lot, the governor during his first campaign promised to create 250,000 new jobs in his first term. These latest numbers show the state would have created around 102,000 jobs under his watch.
And then Governor Walker's take on the report.
So Walker argues that the state is going in the right direction. I mean, he acknowledges that at least during his first term, they're not going to make that goal, but that the state is headed in the right direction. During an appearance yesterday, he cited state jobs numbers that show the unemployment rate dropped from 5.8% in July to 5.6% last month. And just for a bit of perspective, that is below the national average of 6.1%.
All right. Now, somebody should, I joked about it. Somebody should take fantasy football and do it with, state economic numbers, job numbers, GDP, all that stuff. I think there's a game in there.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Although, my fantasy team isn't doing so well. So
okay.
I wouldn't go to me for those kinds of things.
Well, as news people, I don't think we could play.
That's true.
Really. Well, all right. Moving on. One more piece of big election news this week. A lawsuit over what our ballot looks like.
Right, exactly. The state Republican Party here in Wisconsin has filed a lawsuit against the Government Accountability Board, which oversees elections in the state. And the party claims that the agency has developed a confusing ballot that may, in fact, favor Democrats.
Now, it's hard to talk layout and kerning and all that stuff on the radio, but what are Republicans objecting to as far as how this is laid out?
Right. So according to Republicans, what's wrong with the budget? Well, or the ballot, rather.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the Republican Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald argues that because Democrats are listed first on the ballot and there is no sort of demarcation line between those candidates and the office they are seeking, it could lead a voter to think they are incumbents when they're not, or that there is only one candidate running for a particular office.
Okay. And so why are Democrats listed first on the ballot?
Under state law, they are listed first because their party won the presidential race in the last election. And that's sort of what determines who's first in these ballots.
Okay. So what's the remedy that Republicans are seeking here?
They want the JB, the GOP rather, wants the JB to stop using the ballots and have gone to court to force them to do so.
So it would involve new ballots, printing new ballots, it sounds like.
If they were to win in court, yes, that's true.
And so we heard from Kevin Kennedy earlier this week with the Government Accountability Board. Before this happened, though, what's been the response from GAB?
Right. Obviously, this has been a busy few weeks for the GAB, given the ruling with voter ID and now this. Agency officials say, you know, these kinds of complaints aren't unusual around election time, but, you know, have been quick to note that the idea that the ballots were somehow, you know, designed to favor one party over the other, they call it, and this is a direct quote, they call it absurd.
Okay. So would they be able to do it, though?
It's feasible. It's possible. But GAB officials say redesigning the ballot now would be expensive because, frankly, most of the ballots have already been printed.
And Governor Walker's names will be on those ballots. Has he joined this objection to them?
Yeah, it doesn't look like he's really going to weigh in on the specifics of the lawsuit. He said today he's, frankly, not getting involved with the lawsuit and said he'd, quote, leave that up to others, unquote.
Well, speaking of election-related lawsuits— and that's a segue that could go in a number of directions this election season. But let's take it to voter ID.
Yeah.
So we had news earlier this week or late last week on that, but it's still not quite done.
Right. So the plaintiffs who were rebuffed by an appeals court panel in their efforts to stop voter ID in Wisconsin have officially, and we expect this to happen, they officially asked the full court of appeals in Chicago to hear the case.
Right. So bring us up to date on what happened last week.
So last week, just a few hours after oral argument, much to the surprise of you and me and many people in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. a three-judge panel in Chicago allowed the reinstatement of voter ID in Wisconsin. And again, this ruling was, you know, literally hours.
Yeah, that was the surprising.
Yeah, that was the surprising. Yeah, yeah, not the result, but the fact that it happened just in a matter of hours. They allowed the reinstatement of voter ID in Wisconsin. The state elections agency has since announced they will, you know, it'll assume it will be in place for the November election and are making plans to make that happen. Even so, plaintiffs, including the ACLU, want the whole appeals court to hear the case.
Instead of just that three-judge panel.
Yeah, right, exactly. And obviously, you know, they hope to have a different outcome if more judges are involved in the case.
This happens a lot, that things are decided by a three-judge panel. Is it common for the whole appeals court to go back to it again then?
You know, courts rarely grant requests like this. I mean, it's not unprecedented. But it doesn't happen very often.
So even if they did take it too, there might be a matter of timing saying, okay, we're not going to do this before the election. We're going to let it ride as it is. And so there are a lot of question marks before this could happen.
Absolutely. And the state has until next week to submit their response to the request to have the whole court hear this case.
Okay. Well, who knows? Maybe they'll shake up yet another Friday afternoon for us. Noah, thanks for joining us.
It was good to be here. Thanks, Rob.
Noah Ovshinsky is WPR's assistant news director. Stick around, there's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.